Welcome to another Muharatha from the top of the tent, better known as Ras Al Khaimah. In this monthly podcast, we chat about research, education, and arts in the UAE. I'm your host, Dr. Tiffany Lachelle Smith. Thanks for tuning in. Hayakum Allah. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Muharatha Podcast. Today, I am joined by Irfan Nazir, who I am super, super, super excited to talk with about an amazing study that we are going to be diving into in this episode. So, Irfan, welcome to Muharatha.
Thank you so much. And hello, everyone.
All right, let's go in. So, I think it's a perfect time to have this conversation because, although we're at the end, of the 2024 competitive research grant cycle, and just yesterday, April 1st, we were supposed to close the portal, and I was telling you that as soon as it closed at noon, we were getting all these emails from people like, oh, I need to finish my application. You know, I was hoping it would close at 11:59. So we ended up extending until April 19th. So the amazing thing about you is you are one of our 2023 doctoral grant recipients. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And especially for those who are interested in applying for a grant like this, this will be a perfect conversation to just talk about your study, talk about, you know, the experience that you've had here in Ras Al Khaimah, and then maybe even give some advice for those who may be interested in applying as well.
So, certainly.
Okay. All right. So today we're going to be talking about your study, Teaching Nationalism to Non-Nationals, Indian Curriculum Schools. I got it. But before we get into that part, let's start with you. So tell us a little bit about the place that you describe as home.
All right. So I was born and raised in Dubai as a second generation Indian expatriate. And I completed my school education in the UAE. So if you look at that way, UAE was my home during my childhood and much of my teenage days.
Yeah.
So it is always a feeling to connect with this country. I have that a sense of belongingness to this country, though I'm an Indian expatriate, I'm an Indian national, but there's always a feeling that this is my home, the yeah. UAE is my home, and that I carried when I was planning to pursue my higher education in India. I moved to India in 2015 after completing my school education. India also, people identify me as, someone from Dubai at the school.
so this is interesting. And let's just stop for a second because I want to make sure that we do a good job of explaining your identity understanding and then just growing up. Yeah. So birth to K through 12, yeah. because you said higher ed is when you left.
Yeah.
You were schooled in Dubai, raised in Dubai. Dubai is home.
Yeah, I was studying in an Indian curriculum school in both in Dubai and Sharjah. Later on, I moved to a school in Sharjah.
Okay.
So, but an Indian curriculum school. So, but my family was living in Dubai, in Bar Dubai. So.
And how often are you all going to India?
During summer breaks, which is once or twice in 2 years.
So,
like just 1 month vacation. That's all is India for me.
Yeah.
It was just a 1 month of vacation with my grandparents and other relatives at home. So, but much of my time I spent in Dubai or in other Emirates also. I have come to Ras Al Khaimah also. With my first experience with Ras Al Khaimah was coming on a tour with my family to Jebel Jais. And so some of our distant relatives also used to live in Ras Al Khaimah. So we come over weekends to visit them. So that is my first experience with Ras Al Khaimah, to be specific.
Yeah.
But most of my life I spent in, I mean, childhood and teenage days I spent in Dubai.
Yeah.
And perhaps in Sharjah also.
And see, this is why I think your study is so fascinating, because you represent a lot of people in the UAE who you know, you come, you, your family comes from a different country, yeah. but you were born and raised in the UAE.
Yeah.
And you still, you know, just thinking about the physical, thinking about, you know, the language, thinking about, and we're going to go into this because I remember you were talking about some associations and how you held tight to your culture. Mm-hmm. I just think it's amazing because, say, for instance, like you just said, you went to India.
Yeah.
And people in India was like, you're not from here. You're from Dubai.
No, even my my mother tongue is Malayalam. So even when I speak in Malayalam, there is a, it's not a native Malayalam. People can recognize, okay, you're not a well-versed person in Malayalam.
Wow.
There is a slang in your way you speak it because you're more conversing in perhaps in English, in UAE. So that is always there. So people could recognize easily. I'll give you a classic example.
Yeah.
While I went for my undergraduation in Bangalore, there are roads. While crossing the road, it's not like how it is in the UAE. There is no traffic signals where you have to stand at one place.
You just cross the road.
You just go. Yeah. So I was trying to cross the road with my friends, but because I have the experience of going to a traffic signal, pressing the light, waiting for the green light. But it was a completely different experience. My friends were like, if you stand like this, you'll be keeping waiting. You just have to cross the road.
Just get
stop
out there.
Stop the car and cross
OMG.
The road. Don't wait for the red light. So even those kind of experiences, it was like a cultural shock. Once I moved from Dubai, which is a more cosmopolitan and environment, and I went to India, so it was completely... But later on, I adjusted to the Indian environment also.
Yeah. Okay, so then let's, before, because I know this is going to come up in our conversation, so I don't want to jump too fast. But yeah. One of the things that's kind of going on in my mind is the idea that, you know, birth into when you graduated secondary, this was your upbringing in Dubai, like the traffic light. That's a perfect example. Mm-hmm. And then in your latter or early adult years, mm-hmm. you know, you go to India and basically you have to learn a completely different culture.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how you sustain that culture here in Dubai.
Okay. So because I was in an Indian curriculum school, I was having the chance to learn the Indian languages. I learned Malayalam, but it is not as... yeah, not very deep, if you say. It's not as much as how a native learn the Malayalam language. But still, I had the chance to learn the language, and there was social interaction. In the school itself, there were mostly Indian students, so from different states in India.
Uh-huh.
So there was a social interactions.
Yeah.
And my family was also connected to a Kerala-based association, mm-hmm. Which also helped me to understand the culture, the society, I mean, politics, history, literature yeah. of India, specifically the Kerala state. That way, there are a lot of community-based organizations, whether it's Indian community organizations. Within Indian community organizations, there's diverse, which is based on your religious, political, social affiliations
yeah.
in India. So there are such community organizations, and I was fortunate to be part of one of those organizations, which helped me to understand, though being in UAE, I was able to understand the country as well. But the living experience I got once I moved to
India. Okay, so then let's go to India, because especially with all of the associations, you know, the different affiliations that you were able to experience here, mm-hmm. do you feel like it prepared you for this big, was it a culture shock? That's what I'm thinking. Like, to be in India higher ed, was it a culture shock for you?
The initial months, I would say, it was a cultural shock, because I told the example of crossing the road.
Yeah.
And even understanding the bus routes or hiring an auto rickshaw, taxi. Because
auto rickshaw, even that word.
Yeah, even let's say if you have to go in a taxi or in an auto rickshaw, you have to bargain with the person.
Mm-hmm.
But in UAE, it's like it's a fixed rate. Mm-hmm. If you take a metro in Dubai or it's a taxi, it's a fixed rate.
Yeah.
You pay that fixed rate. But there they will say an exponentially high rate, and you just have to bring them down. Okay.
So you were a tourist then? They saw you as a tourist. Yeah, you got the tourist price.
I got the tourist price, definitely. Then my friends were also, Irfan, this wouldn't work this way. You had to bargain with them.
Else you'll just,
your pocket will be empty.
Very quickly.
Yeah. So.
Oh, I love that.
So I moved to Bangalore, which is a city in southern India.
Okay.
Fortunately, my cousins were there. So I was able to adjust quickly with the Bangalore environment. I studied in a university there, where I did my undergraduate in history, economics, and political science.
Okay.
So there, I had a chance to write an undergraduate dissertation also, which was connected to Kerala, my home state in India, Kerala's Gulf connection, how Kerala migrants were connected to the Gulf countries.
Okay.
So that is when I got a bit interest in this part of the world, as a research interest in this part of the world, the Gulf countries, particularly the UAE. Then I moved to Delhi, India's capital. For my post-graduation, I did my MA in politics with specialization in international relations from Jawaharlal Nehru University, which is one of India's premier university named after India's first prime minister.
Okay.
Jawaharlal Nehru University, or we call it JNU. So at JNU, I was 2 years of my master's program. I did a lot of optional courses there, which were connected to Middle Eastern studies.
Okay.
Which again developed my interest towards this particular region, particularly the UAE. Then I immediately after my post-graduation, I applied for a PhD in Middle Eastern studies. And I started my PhD program. And while discussing with my doctoral advisor, we were discussing multiple topics, what to work exactly on the within the Middle East. And we came down towards, okay, you're working on UAE.
because
you have the living experience there, so you definitely should work on UAE.
Exactly.
You need to have an you already have some basic understanding of the UAE. Now it's easier for you to develop it into a full-fledged academic interest, research interest.
Yeah.
So now I'm researching about the UAE, sitting in New Delhi.
Exactly.
Now with the, while I was leaving Dubai in 2015, I left as a late teenage going to the university. Now I'm back in this country as a researcher studying about this country.
I know, which I think is so fascinating because it's almost like you flipped, right? You were born and raised here in the UAE and then you left and had this culture shock in India.
Yeah.
And then in India, you decided, well, you know, I'm interested in the UAE. So now let me come back and study this place that I was born and raised, which I think is amazing because it kind of segues into the next question, which is really just an understanding about how you came to this particular research. So your research is focusing on this idea of nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting because I'm thinking about the statistics that you're writing about in your policy paper, nationalism for a population that is the minority in this country. And how this nationalism is taught to expatriates, to non-nationals, who is the majority, right, of this country.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about, you know, what this interest is and how you came to this interest in nationalism.
Yeah, as I was saying that one reason why I decided on the UAE was my living experience there.
So, which is what?
Yeah, I'm coming to that.
Yeah, because I'm like, dig into it.
So living experience in the UAE.
Yeah.
So I was discussing with my doctoral advisor as to what exactly I should work on for my doctoral dissertation.
Okay.
We decided UAE. And what on UAE? That was the next question. What exactly on UAE? Then we discussed a lot of topics like this no, yes. Okay, this can be partially yes.
Okay.
then we narrowed it down to school education, which is a very relevant topic all the time because for policymakers, for all stakeholders, education is one of the key focus area, including the Al-Qasimi Foundation.
Yeah.
So we decided on education, school education, and first we were discussing whether should it be higher education or school education. Then we decided let it be school education.
Okay.
Then we were on, okay, that is school education is one variable. Let's say variable X. What should be the variable Y? So we came to a conclusion that while studying the school education, it should not be just pedagogy or teaching or learning process. It should also, since I'm from a politics and international relations background, Middle Eastern studies background, it should also, while studying the education, it should also reflect the UAE society.
Mm-hmm.
It should also reflect the UAE state, policies, state institutions, society, culture, history. It should also reflect that. Then I came up with, okay, the UAE has been, especially in the last decade, has been actively promoting its national identity, Emirati national identity.
Mm.
And my first underlying assumption was that it is just for the nationals, which is the scholarly consensus. If you look at the nationalism studies, all the scholars argue that nationalism is for nationals.
Mm. Oh, so, okay.
Yeah. But and the non-nationals are always excluded from that discourses.
Mm.
But while going further into the literature and looking at the UAE's example, I realized that it's not just for the nationals, it's also for the non-nationals.
Yeah.
So UAE nationalism or the national identity, the Ministry of Education is promoting the UAE national identity through school education for the Emirati population, but not just the Emirati population, but it's also for the expatriate population, which is significant in the number, because the UAE recognizes that there is a need to sensitize its majority expatriate population
exactly.
to the history, culture, sensitized to them. And because, as you also said, that the Emiratis are minority in their own country, of course, there will be a sense of concern, fear, what would happen to their identity, what would happen to their culture,
mm-hmm.
Will it be taken over by the expatriates? So it is an obvious concern to have.
Yeah.
Suppose, let's say, someone is knocking at your door. And you see that 10 people are standing outside. Suddenly, you will be threatened. You don't know who they are, but should I welcome them inside my home?
Yeah, exactly.
So that concern would be there. So the state's task here is also to tell the person who the owner of the house, which is local,
exactly.
that, see, you should not feel threatened by this people. You can welcome them. And at the same time, the visitors, you need to sensitize them to the home, etiquette of the home.
Exactly.
How the culture is, how the tradition, I mean, what are the rituals we follow. You need to have a respect to that. So it is a dual process.
Yeah.
At this, you are telling the Emiratis that you don't have to worry. We are a society which is embracing tolerance, coexistence. We have that culture, rich heritage passed on by our religion, by our traditions, by our great leaders. So we can welcome them. And you're telling the expatriates also, you're welcome to work, come here, work,
yeah.
and live in this country. But at the same time, respect our culture,
exactly.
our traditions. So it's a twin process.
That's a beautiful analogy.
So the state always have to ensure that balance. You have to preserve the traditions. At the same time, you can embrace the cosmopolitanism.
Yeah.
That is what the UAE is. And the UAE is the best case to study that because of that Emiratis and the expatriate, that population, which I don't think you can find it in any other country. That's why UAE is a unique case itself.
Yeah. See, I think it's fascinating. I mean, even just thinking about, you know, the analogy of the 10 people outside of the door and, you know, how do you still welcome them, explain the culture, embrace the culture. And unfortunately, I mean, I feel like, and maybe this will kind of segue into your study, sometimes it is a choice. Right? How sensitized you want to be to the culture, to the language, to, and I have to beat myself up too about this Arabic language because I've been living in the UAE for too long to not, you know, be speaking the language. But let's go a little deeper into your study and talk a little bit about the design, because I know initially you were interested in investigating national identity through textbooks. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about, you know, what your original design was and then essentially what you ended up doing.
But before that, I'll try to give you a background to my study as to the historical context, because that would perhaps help you to perhaps understand my methodology as well.
Okay.
So as I was talking about these tensions between the nationals and the non-nationals, but if you look at the history of the UAE, the UAE was established in 1971. And before that, there was no Emirati national identity. An identity was there, not there, because the British decided to withdraw from the Trucial States. In the 1960s, the rulers of this region came together and decided that for the benefit of our people, for our safety and security, we should come together as a union and form the United Arab Emirates. If there is no sense of belongingness and identity to your nation, it wouldn't survive for long. Suppose, let's say, I'm an Indian. If I have that feeling that I'm an Indian, then only I feel connected to my country, right? Suppose if you're from Germany, you should have a belonging, a feeling that you are from a German, so you need to have a connection to Germany. Similarly, in the UAE's case, there was no Emirati identity. Rulers and the people have to construct an Emirati national identity for the people. And it was a process of last 4 to 5 decades. Mm-hmm. And they successfully constructed an identity, which is based on your tribal Bedouin heritage, Arab Islamic traditions, and they were able to unify their armed forces. They created their constitution, the national symbols, and they successfully constructed an Emirati national identity for themselves.
Mm.
But later on, towards the 21st century, the challenge came, which is of the expatriates. Now we have a national identity. Now how do we accommodate the expatriate population into this national identity? So as I told about the tensions, of course, as a result, there is a tension as to how to accommodate the expatriates into the national identity framework. As a result, the state has tried to balance it out. Now, there are various ways to do with it. Now, you can, there'll be a lot of state-led projects. Let us say heritage village projects or museums, setting up the museums or cultural festivals. So along with that, they also recognize that we need to also take time into the school education as well. Education is one of the fields where we can inculcate the national narratives to the UAE nationals as well as the expatriate population. So they have to revise the entire curriculum, textbooks to imbibe the elements of Emirati national identity, which is cultural identity based on your language, religion, tradition, Bedouin tradition, then your civic identity, loyalty to the country, your national flag, founding father, the civic identity.
Yeah.
At the same time, the cosmopolitan identity, which is based on tolerance, coexistence, mutual respect. This all comprises the Emirati national identity. Now, this needs to be taught both to the expatriate population as well as the Emiratis. And that is being done, as I said, through the school textbooks, curriculum. So what I decided to do is that I'm looking at how the UAE state is preserving and promoting the Emirati national identity based on these three elements: civic, cosmopolitan, and cultural identity is being promoted through school education.
Okay.
Now, both to the expatriates and the Emiratis. So I primarily looked at the school textbooks, how this has been done. So I was looking at UA social studies textbooks, Islamic education, moral education curriculums to see how these elements have been brought into the school curriculum textbooks as well as the school curriculum. Then I realized that it should not end with that itself, just not just the textbooks. I need to see how the schools are also responding to this. Now, the state has been implementing that. State has been giving the textbooks curriculum to the schools, say that you need to implement these things. You need to teach your students these things. But how does the schools respond? Now, schools, you can take it as public and private schools. Now, public schools, they just have to follow their curriculum design based on the ministry curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
But for private international curriculum schools, it's a challenge. Why it is a challenge is they have to, suppose it is a British curriculum school. They are following a British curriculum in their respective school, whether it's in Ras Al Khaimah or Sharjah, anywhere. They're following a British curriculum school. Now they have to implement the subjects which has been prescribed by the Ministry of Education, the Arabic language, Islamic education, social studies, and moral education into the British curriculum.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they have to accommodate these four subjects. And they also have to take into the consideration the timing, because let us say if it's a British curriculum or Indian curriculum, they have been designed, let us say Indian curriculum has been designed based in New Delhi, or British curriculum is designed based in London, let us say, or Cambridge. So they have to take into those considerations while designing. An Indian curriculum is not designed based on the realities of the UAE. It is designed based on the realities of India. So in India, let us say the number of working hours is 230. 230 working hours in an academic year. But in the UAE's case, it's just 180 working hours. So for an Indian curriculum school, let us say, they have to implement the 230 curriculum based on 230 working hours into a context where the number of working hours is only 180. And along with that, you need to implement four other subjects. So what are the challenges which the school face? So that is something that I felt that is not at all explored. What are the challenges? How they are accommodating that? What are the state support? What are the state advice to do that? The Ministry of Education, what are they advising that? How are the schools responding to that? How are they balancing it out? So this is something I felt is also necessary to understand while I'm looking at the school textbooks. Is it actually reaching the students or the schools are implementing it properly? The textbooks or curriculum which has been implemented, do they face any challenges? Do they face any time constraint? Do they have the qualified teachers to teach these subjects?
Yeah.
So these are the certain things I thought I should look at the periphery. At the core, I'm looking at the school curriculum textbooks. At the periphery, I'm looking at how these players are interacting as well, which will enrich my understanding about the state-led projects on national identity into the schools.
Yeah. Just having those conversations about, you know, are teachers qualified? Are they prepared? You know, what are the challenges that schools are facing? You talked with school leaders, and then you also talked with a few students. What did you find out?
As part of my research, I went across to different international curriculum schools and spoke to the school leaders. I got a chance to speak to a few of the teachers also. And I also had a chance to participate in the National Day celebration of one of the schools. What I understand is that the ministry, as I said, has given a set of curriculum regulations to be implemented in the schools. These textbooks, the curriculum has to be implemented. And in private schools, there are certain inspection. Every year, there will be an inspection in these schools by the ministry or their emirate-level regulatory authorities. So for that, they have an inspection framework, which is outlining what the state or the ministry is expecting in the schools. Based on those criteria, they inspect the schools and rate these schools based on outstanding, good, very good, acceptable, weak. These ratings are given. So if the school is performing in this indicator beyond the expectations of the government, they'll be rated outstanding. Beyond the expectation, they'll be rated outstanding. If it's below the expectation, they'll be given weak or acceptable. So in this inspection framework, there are parameters for national identity, how the schools are been promoting the Islamic values, how the attainment of Arabic languages, how the students are given an exposure to the Emirati culture and the world cultures at the same time, a cosmopolitan environment, and how they are able to bring in these elements of Emirati identity into their regular curriculum, how they are adapting to that curriculum. So all these are being given by the ministry or the regulatory authorities. So the schools are supposed to implement this. And one of the and they are successfully doing that. In terms of curriculum adaptation, I was talking to one of the school principals in Russell Gaima, and we were discussing about how the moral education and social studies have been implemented in the school. And I moved on to the next question, saying that how it has been done beyond these subjects, outside the school activities. Then he told me that it is not over yet. He has more to add on. Then he told me that though it is this following this international curriculum, they're supposed to implement bringing the elements of national identity, not through the UA social studies, moral education, Islamic studies, but even through mathematics, English, sciences. And he gave me an example also. He was like, suppose in a primary elementary level English class, you learn A for apple, B for ball. Now let us turn it into A for Abu Dhabi, B for Burj Khalifa, C for camel, D for Dubai.
Okay.
Or let us say, if it's in a mathematics class, you teach three apples plus three apples, six apples. Now you can say, given examples, let's say three emirates plus three emirates, six emirates. How many emirates does the UAE have? Seven emirates. Now minus the six emirates from the seven emirates, how many emirates are remaining? One emirate.
Wow. Okay.
So the principal started giving me this sort of examples. Then I realized that, it's not through these subjects, whether it's Islamic or UAE social studies, moral education, but even in your regular curriculum, you're supposed to give in these examples, demonstrate examples. Or I was talking to another principal in Abu Dhabi. So he was telling me that you're teaching the students. It is more in a secondary level. So he was telling me that suppose a biology teacher or ecology teacher teaches about environment conservation or protection of environment. They can also bring the examples of mangroves in the UAE.
Yeah.
They give the examples of Hobara birds, bird conservation, and they take them to the incubation center. Though in their textbooks, which is based on a British curriculum or an Indian curriculum, these examples wouldn't be there in the textbooks. But the teacher is supposed to bring in these examples, which is locally rooted examples, into the curriculum. So one research finding is that they are able to accommodate, adapt their international curriculum to bring in the elements of Emirati national identity.
Yeah.
That is number one. And secondly, now beyond these curriculum teaching of these subjects, other subjects, curriculum adaptation, there are school events, activities, practices. Suppose a morning assembly starts with the recitation from the verses of Holy Quran, then the UAE national anthem. Suppose it's an Indian curriculum school, they play both the Indian national anthem and the, both the UAE national anthem and the Indian national anthem together. Okay. So those kind of things, and whether it's a decorations at the schools or if it's a national day celebrations, they celebrate Ramadan, then Eid, observe commemoration day. They have Flag Day celebration. They celebrate Hakka Layla. Hakka Layla is something that I never seen in Indian curriculum school at the time I was studying.
Okay.
I was surprised. Now it is even brought into the Indian curriculum schools, Hakka Layla celebrations.
Oh, nice.
So those ways, the state has been actively giving instructions to the schools. These are the ways you can implement. And states have been doing that. Now, challenge is one with reference to the timing, adjusting the timing. But one school leader told me that it is a time-tested one. They have been doing for decades now. So that's not really an issue. But still, some schools are struggling with the timing. Some are resolving that by curriculum adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps link the UA social studies, ecology with the regular ecology subjects. So they're doing some sort of curriculum mapping adaptations. That is not really a challenge, but the challenge is coming with the Arabic language.
Yeah.
That is something not just my policy paper is based on the Indian curriculum schools, but it's not just Indian curriculum schools. Indian curriculum schools have other set of issues also. But the challenge is that they have a certain time frame to teach the subject. I think it's 4 hours per week is what the time allotted for the Arabic language. And they are supposed to teach the subject within that time. And that is just like any other subject. But the issue that this is a language and which requires more effort.
Yeah.
To learn, or you won't be able to pick up the conversational skills if you don't converse in the language, right? That is one challenge which the schools face. And unlike other subjects, whether it's English or let us say if you're learning an Indian language or any other language in the schools, even the parents cannot help their children with Arabic language because they don't have knowledge on the Arabic language.
Yeah.
So if the child goes, the child is only getting 4 hours in the school to learn this language, and this child goes to the home, parents cannot help. And this is evident in the Indian curriculum schools. The composition of the schools you need to also see. Indian curriculum schools is mostly comprised of South Asian nationals and Southeast Asian nationals. And there are hardly any Arab nationals in these schools.
Okay.
So there is, even at the peer group level, there is no interaction with an Arab national. They have never seen an Arab. They might see them outside, but they have hardly have any conversation with an Arab national or an Arab student or anyone who can speak an Arabic language. There is no avenue for them to speak an Arabic language.
Wow.
So you're learning technically in that environment where you're learning a language, but there is no scope for conversation, there is no scope for improvement. What happens is that they just do some rote learning. And also there is no incentive also to learn because no one converses in the language.
Yeah.
And they feel that perhaps after your schooling, you might go to India or any European countries for higher education. So you don't really need the language. But while I was conversing with some of the Indian expats who decided to continue in the UAE, once they enter the job market, some of them have the chance to speak to the Arab nationals.
Yeah.
And communicate, have friend circles who are Arabs. So then they regret, oh, I should have learned the Arabic language in the school. Then it would have been easier for me to converse with them in the Arabic language, pick up the Arabic language, or perhaps it would have given me a better job opportunities. That sort of thinking is only coming once they are out of school setting.
Exactly.
In the school, they are not taking the language seriously. That is what even some of the school leaders also told that. This is something that is facing with the let us say in Indian curriculum schools. A British curriculum school principal told me a different set of issue. In Arabic itself, Arabic has been taught in two levels, which is advanced Arabic and basic Arabic, which is Arabic A and Arabic B.
Okay.
And advanced Arabic has been taught to the Arab passport holders. Whoever comes from the Arab country who having an Arab passport is being taught this advanced Arabic. For the remaining rest of the population, they've been taught Arabic B, which is basic Arabic.
Exactly.
Now, the challenge is that suppose a person who holds an Egyptian passport and the person was born and brought up in Canada.
Mm.
Okay. And that person has to come. The child's parents got a job in the UAE, has to come here and join in the school. And since the person holds a Egyptian passport, needs to learn the advanced Arabic in the UAE setting. So that is again a challenge with the Arabic language. The child has no exposure to the Arabic language because the person was living in Canada. And the person has to come to UAE and learn advanced Arabic because the person holds an Egyptian passport, which is an Arab passport.
Exactly.
So the challenge of Arabic language is concerning, not just in Indian curriculum school, but in a British curriculum school, though there is a significant Arab population compared to what is in Indian curriculum school, but they also face a different set of challenges in this
way. Well, okay, so hold on because...
Yeah.
So for the sake of time, you have given us a lot of information, and this is so fascinating. I mean, I think it's so interesting to think about, and I can tell that, you know, the study actually went well. Much of the information that you gathered is super interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
Tell us a little bit about what you hoped from this study. I know that you have policy recommendations, but I can tell that there's also some passion in just, you know, being able to assist NGM curriculum schools with really integrating this idea of national identity. Mm. And then the other thing, while you're talking about that, if you could talk a little bit about being a grant recipient, and specifically for those who may be interested in applying, talk about how this opportunity allowed you to, you know, conduct the study.
If I had to read the school textbooks, I could have done it in India.
True.
I could have just got the copies of the textbooks, sit in India and read it. I didn't have to come for a 6 months fieldwork in based in Ras Al Khaimah and other
areas.
True. Yeah. So that's also another reason I thought that if I'm getting a grant, I should utilize it to the maximum. My topic, national identity, as I told you, it's a state-led project. State has been doing through multiple avenues. School is just one aspect of
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
There's been, let's say, whether it's a heritage festival. For example, let me give you in Ras Al Khaimah itself, Ras Al Khaimah Art Festival at Al Jazeera Al Hamra,
mm-hmm.
which was a bringing together of your traditions, cosmopolitanism, and creativity together.
Mm-hmm.
So, and when I was looking at the crowd, it's not just the Emiratis there. People from across the, all nationalities come there, and artists from different countries come there. And which is the work which has been done by the government in Ras Al Khaimah, supported by the Al Qasimi Foundation. So you get to see what the UAE state is trying to do, balancing the cosmopolitanism, traditions at the same time. So if I hadn't seen that, I wouldn't recognize what are the efforts which I've been doing. And if you see any sort of activities or if you go through a street, I'm living in Corniche Al-Kawasim. So within, if I just take a panoramic view of Corniche, I can see a lot of elements of national identity there.
Let's say
Sheikh Zayed Mosque. It's yeah. been named after the UAE's founding father. And the UAE flag is there. The Union flag is there. And at the Corniche, you have a lot of cafes, which are modern cafes. International brands are there. But the architecture is traditional, which is the traditional wind tower. So they're trying to balance the cosmopolitanism and traditions. Now you have iftar cannon firing over there happening. Every evening,
scares me sometimes.
Yeah. As a grant recipient, I got an opportunity to understand how it has been done in person, go into the field, experience it myself. And it's not an experience that I go to a school, interview a principal, any school leader or teacher and come back. While going back, I perhaps have a conversation with the taxi driver.
Exactly.
And perhaps the taxi driver itself would have certain things to say. I was in Abu Dhabi and I went to the temple which was opened recently. So I took a taxi who was a Pakistani driver. And I got in the taxi and I told that I need to go to this Hindu mandir which has been inaugurated just a week before. Then he's like, yeah, I don't know the route. I'm also going there for first time. Then I put a navigation. Then he was also excited to see the temple along with myself because he also wanted to see. He hasn't gone to that route before. So it was also first time experience for him. Then he was talking about his experience as a taxi driver in UAE. He was living in Dubai before, then he moved to Abu Dhabi. He was telling that he had a fight with some of the customers in Dubai, then he had to move to Abu Dhabi. So it was literally fun talking to a driver. At the same time, I can understand how a taxi driver, how he sees the country. Some of them were talking about leaving their families away and staying alone in this country, mm-hmm. their concerns. They have to get married early. Some of them were telling me to get married.
Wow.
Like, what is your age? Then I told I'm 27. Then the taxi driver was like, I got married at 22. You should marry now. It's high time you get married. So,
it's time.
Yeah, so you get to interact with I got to interact with different stakeholders, not just in the school setting, but also others, even if it's a Talabat delivery boy. Even if I'm ordering on Talabat, now since it's Ramadan, I can see suhoor deals, Ramadan deals. So
right.
I can see how consumerism or culture, everything come together during the Ramadan festival time. So these are some of the experiences at the field, which you never get if you're doing a research, let's say, sitting in New Delhi. I would just read the textbooks and write, okay, this page number says this thing.
Exactly.
Now I can ration out saying that this page says about tolerance because then I can give the examples
exactly.
from my field observation notes saying that how the tolerance or coexistence. I can give the example of my temple visit with a taxi driver. So these are the things. So for that reason, I'm thankful to Al Qasimi Foundation for giving me this wonderful opportunity to be in Ras Al Khaimah and supporting me to travel to other Emirates, experience literally experience the UAE. And I'm sure that that will be definitely reflected in my doctoral dissertation.
Amen. So I have to tell you, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. And we are definitely wishing you good luck and a speedy, how do you say, a writing experience with finishing up your dissertation.
Thank you so much. It was really good experience talking to you about my 6 months of experience.
Thank you, Irfan.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to another Muharatha from the top of the tent, better known as Ras Al Khaimah. In this monthly podcast, we chat about research, education, and arts in the UAE. I'm your host, Dr. Tiffany Lachelle Smith. Thanks for tuning in. Hayakumala.